Welcome to A Cup of Java with Dr. Nava. And here we are so excited to have Dr. Pesha Kotenik join us. Pesha is the head of school of Manhattan Day School. Prior to joining the MBS family, she served 2 decades in Jewish education, 15 in school leadership at Yeshiva Har Torah and Benos Malka Academy. Dr. Kotenik received her doctorate in education from the Learning and Teaching Program at Hofstra University with a specialization in human development and educational psychology and a master's of science in school psychology from the Touro Graduate School of Education and Psychology. Dr. Kotenik has been an Avichai Fellow and a scholar in residence for the Orthodox Union Women's Initiative, as well as a guest lecturer at Hofstra University's Graduate School of Education. She is currently a student in the Fish Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at Yeshiva University. Dr. Kotenik has written about parenting and Jewish education in the Lookstein Jewish Educational Leadership Journal and the Panim Journal. She lives in West Hempstead with her husband and her 3 children. And I have the wonderful privilege of working with Dr. Pesha Kotenik, and I enjoy that opportunity so much. And just to start us off, I know you went recently on this incredible trip, which relates to your Holocaust studies. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about where you went and kind of some of the take homes that you had from that trip.
Dr. Nava, it is an honor to be here and really a privilege to work with you and learn from you every day. I guess when you were reading the bio, you're like, one of these things is not like the other, you know, education, school psychology, and then it's like, Holocaust, what is that? So it is definitely a personal high interest area for me. Certainly for my family's story, it's important to me. But I'm very much inspired by Jewish history. And when I think about the trying times of the Holocaust, and I appreciate where we are today in the Jewish community, I'm inspired. I recently went with the Fish Center on a 2-week program through Central Europe. We started in Prague, we ended in Krakow, and we made our way through Slovakia, which really has a rich Jewish history and is not as visited as some of the other areas. And we went to different synagogues, cemeteries, places that used to really be heavily populated by Jews, and really no Jews live there anymore. So some highlights. I was so inspired when we went to Terezin, which is known as Theresienstadt, the German name, the ghetto area. And we go underneath and we find a synagogue that is just an inspiration that people were praying and reaching out to God then. There was an art teacher who really pulled the children together in the ghetto and used art therapy through trying times to, you know, help them connect to their feelings, help them get through the times. And those pieces of artwork, to look at them as a teacher, I just started to cry because, you know, we think about our role in terms of inspiring children, protecting children, and just what it must have been like to be an educator and not feel like you could fully protect children. And what do you do for them then? I was inspired to visit. We went to Vienna and I saw a community that, you know, was totally challenged and destroyed almost, but really is growing and booming right now. And you see layers of Jewish history there that are just so profound. You know, when erecting the Holocaust Memorial in Vienna and excavating to do so, they bumped into an old synagogue that was there in the 1400s that had been abandoned during that time period. And so just how do you honor these different layers of Jewish history and at the same time think about and honor sort of the strength and vitality? You know, I prayed in a synagogue that withstood what we call Kristallnacht, the night of the broken glass, which was a famous pogrom. It withstood it because Eichmann used it as his office. And to pray there and think about like how it made it through when the fact that it was now populated and renewed and had, you know, hangings on the wall from hundreds and hundreds of years of Jewish history was just so inspiring.
Wow. I can imagine all those visualizations. And as an educator yourself, what it would have been like to to be a teacher during that time, or someone who's trying to still serve as an educator without any of the resources and with all of the traumas that were going on at the time. I have during Kristallnacht, the Night of Broken Glass, I had a relative who rescued a bunch of Torahs, and we have one of them as a family Torah right now. And, you know, looking back using these relics or the synagogues or the locations where you saw that artwork, what an incredible way to recall that time and really picture what life must have been like then. You have been in Jewish education now for over 20 years. You have such a wealth of experience from different locations and schools that you've been in. How do you believe that Jewish education has evolved over time? What have you seen in terms of what stayed the same? What seems to have changed? What do you think?
Sure. And just to kind of connect our prior question to this upcoming question, when I think about just Jewish education specifically, you know, we just came out of a pandemic, and I'm always hesitant to even say that word because nobody even wants to hear about it anymore. But a lot of the private Jewish day schools did stay open during that time period. And when I reflected on, you know, why is that? How did that happen? And I think back to these trying times. You know, there was school running in the Warsaw Ghetto. There, you know, we just talked about Theresienstadt. You know, I think just when we say we are a people of the book, and we are a future thinking people. You know, one of my famous speeches that I've given before is that at the holiest night of the Jewish year, one of them is what we call Seder night on Passover. And that night is actually not kicked off by the oldest person at the table, it's kicked off by the youngest person at the table. And so when you think about how is it that the Hebrews and the Israelites or the Jewish people have lasted or stayed so long, it's because even though we keep our rich heritage with us, we're very forward thinking, we're very future oriented. And so the youngest child starts off by asking questions. And I think that there's such deep, profound messages there. We look to the youngest child and we start with questions, you know, rather than an older person saying this is the canon and you need to follow it. It's more open, it's discussion, and we differentiate. We think about all the different types of children. And so when I think about the long range goal of Jewish education and then my own small experiences in it, you know, I'm inspired by our story. And how under whatever circumstances we think, you know, how are the children doing? What are we doing for the children? And how are we preparing them to carry on our legacy? And I have noticed, you know, just kind of honing into our daily experience, our weekly experience, I have seen changes over the past 2 decades. I've been in Jewish education for over 2 decades, and I've seen some big changes. One of the biggest things I could say over the past decade specifically is I found that I've been spending a lot of my time working with parents on parenting, actually. I think that, you know, people say, what's with kids these days? And I like to remind everyone, the babies are born, you know, we're different. You know, the babies, the children, we're the ones who are setting kind of a different environment. And I think it's important. And, you know, Dr. Nava, you and I have done this together. We've reflected, you know, what is contributing to things that are different today? So just putting on the table, you know, we have technology.
Yep.
And I think we also, especially in New York City, we have a very driven group of people, and we want the best for our children. And so we want to set them up for success. And a lot of energy goes into that. And so I try to say, what kind of messages are we giving? And one moment where I really reflected as a parent myself, and I'll just say I have 3 teenagers, totally outnumbered. I have an 18-year-old, an almost 17-year-old, and I have a 14-year-old. And I had a really difficult time reaching one of my children. I would call them and I would text them and I just couldn't get through. And they're like, Ma, I'm only on Snapchat. So I download Snapchat and I open it up to send a message. And the first thing that happens is I see my own image reflected in it, like to take a picture of myself. And so I was just thinking about like the evolution of communication, you know, right. Like, so we used to write letters, call people. And then we started writing messages, quick messages on the phone. And now if I message someone, the first thing that comes up is a picture of me that I'm sending them. And so when I think about like our medium, and then I think about the fact that our children today have been so photographed, I think if you held a phone up to any age group of children, they would like smile at you, posed for a picture. And so we as parents appreciate having these pictures, but I wonder what messages we're giving the children. What are we focusing on? What have we turned them into?
You know, I think that's a really important thing to think about, especially considering body image disorders, disordered eating, a complete focus on physicality. And it's a really important conversation. And whether it's social media and issues of cyberbullying or constant fixation on physical looks, that's a wonderful point that that is the first go-to for many of our teenagers these days. You know, something else that you've spoken about that I think is a fascinating topic and so important for parents is this idea of snowplow parenting, this kind of method of parenting where we are kind of, you know, not allowing our kids to fail and to go through the trials and tribulations of what it takes to be a person and a problem solver in this world. Can you tell us a bit more about your views on snowplow parenting?
Sure. And I think it ties in actually perfectly to our conversation about technology, because technology has accelerated what we used to call helicopter parenting. But the reason I like to use snowplow is because I feel like helicopter doesn't even capture it anymore. So in what ways has technology impacted this? So I think, you know, when I think back to moments when I was a child, so two of my children are learning how to drive. And so when I first started learning how to drive, there weren't cell phones, not to date myself. And so I had a lot more freedom. And a lot of opportunity to have to make responsible decisions by myself. And so I'm actually relieved as a parent of drivers, teenage drivers, that there are phones today. So I'm not going to ever say that there isn't value to it. But I think I find that children find themselves in situations where instead of, you know, figuring out what to do, they'll call or text their parent. You know, one mom a few years ago had called for my advice about something. She had been looking at her children's social media and text messages, which I highly advise. And that's a whole nother podcast, Dr. Nava, about how to, in a healthy way, monitor your children on social media. And she had noticed that another girl had written something really mean to her daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, what do you think I should do? And in the conversation, it dawned on me. And I said to her, I said, look, there's a few layers here. One is you have to protect your child. Absolutely. And we have to teach them who's a good friend and who's not. But there's another piece to it. If that child had said something not nice to your daughter in the bathroom at school, your daughter would have the autonomy to decide when she's telling you that, how she's going to get advice. Maybe she would respond there or not, or something would happen that she would learn from, you know, that type of a thing. And instead, you know, like we're talking about, well, should I bring this up because I saw it? And my advice to her was to keep an eye on it, because we, number one, have to protect our children. And at the same time, to let her daughter have that autonomy to decide, you know, what to do with this piece of information. Obviously, if there's something dangerous, and that's another important thing, that our children are involved in things that you know, they're exposed to that are very challenging, that definitely keep an eye on. Everything you have to keep an eye on. But I do reflect on this autonomy a lot. You know, there's two other places that I've seen this come up a lot, certainly from the vantage point of a school administrator. Parents will say to me, you know, my child didn't bring home their homework, and I went onto the class WhatsApp chat, and you know, I posted this, I posted that. I guess if I could give one piece of advice to school age children parents, let your child forget their homework and face the natural consequences of not having that. There is no better low stakes way to learn responsibility than not bringing in elementary school homework. And so when your child comes to you and says, I forgot my homework, A parent should say to their child, well, what are you going to do about that? And the child might say, well, I don't know. And so if you want to troubleshoot with them, you know, there are things they could do. They could call a friend. They could prepare a conversation to have with their teacher, which is uncomfortable, but a very important life skill, to go up to someone and say, I forgot my homework. How can I make it up? And maybe they have to come up with a plan with the teacher. Maybe they have double homework the next night. Maybe they have to do it during recess. This idea that the child owns the problem is the only way that we're going to set them up for that sort of adult experience. And then the other way that I've seen parents intervene, that I have done some coaching and you know, I've definitely seen, you know, parents change their perspective after conversation is if their child is, let's say, sent to the office or gets in trouble in school, and they'll get an email from their child during school. So what to do during that moment? I'm a parent. I know that terrible feeling. That is a terrible feeling when you know your child's going through something difficult. But at the same time, there's, as you know, the famous book, The Blessing of a Skin Knee, they have that opportunity to navigate that situation. I had one time, you know, there was a parent trying to reach me all day because she got an email that her child was, I think, breaking the dress code. And when I finally got on the phone with her, I said to her, I said, look, when you were in school and you did something wrong and you got sent to the principal's office, what did you do? And she said, oh, I had to figure out what to do. I said, please give your daughter that opportunity to figure out what to do. There's a rule in school. There was some trouble with communication that happened or something she did. Maybe she broke the rule. Maybe she didn't. Maybe she has to advocate for herself. Give her a chance. I'm not saying don't be there. Don't help them. Don't support them. But give them a chance to develop that voice, that autonomy, that ability to make a choice.
I love that so much. I think it's so important to build kids' resilience. Again, their problem-solving skills, even to make them grittier, you know, having to deal with things on their own, work through problems on their own, even if they are uncomfortable conversations or uncomfortable confrontations. What a gift you are giving to your children if you're giving them that opportunity. So we've covered a lot in a short time already, both with Jewish education, social media, and snowplow parenting. I know that there have been also a lot of wonderful progressive changes that have come in the guise of math education and literacy education. What are your thoughts on some of the newfangled ways that schools are approaching mathematics and approaching the science of reading, for instance? What are your thoughts on them? Do you think we're headed in the right direction? What do you think?
So, okay, now we're getting to the loaded questions, Dr. Nava. So one of my favorite comments is like when parents ask me about new math. Math is the same. 1 + 1 = 2. There are patterns in math. Math is the same. I think what we know more now is we know more about how children learn and think. And we're able to, in a developmentally appropriate way, teach them. And at the same time, you know, I'm a research data-driven educator. And so we're able to collect data and research to help us understand better how children learn. So some of the things that we have seen from this research, we'll start with math, and then I think we'll move into literacy, is that, you know, number one, we start with the concrete and we move to pictorial and we move to operational. And that's why children start with what we call math toys or math manipulatives. But there's another piece that really, I think, touches upon some of the other things we were talking about. We have noticed, we have learned by learning about the brain, by learning about how people learn and remember things, that productive struggle is a very impactful way to learn. So in simple terms, if you get a problem that is difficult and you are coached by an educator or a parent to kind of persevere through it and enjoy the struggle, and see, you know, oh, this number doesn't seem to add up correctly. I'm going to go back and try it again. You know, those are the life skills that are going to be more important. You know, in education, we talk about today how we're preparing children for jobs that don't exist yet. That's how rapid our world is changing. And so automaticity, which is, you know, knowing your number facts by heart, which we recommend in education, generally speaking, is not going to propel a person in the future, but creative thinking will, perseverance will, teamwork will. And so a lot of what people are seeing in, let's say, the math programs that seem new or feel new are really not that. Is not that there's like all these new ideas totally, but the world is new. And we're leaning into things that we've researched and watched over time and we see that works. One of the areas that I definitely have had conversations with parents about is they'll say, well, this is so hard. Can't we just kind of, you know, lay it out easier for the child and then they can follow the formula? And I think, again, it's another place where we're taking away such an important opportunity for them. When you think about anything that you value that you've done in your life, you've worked hard, you might have fallen and picked yourself up, you've learned from your mistakes. And so a healthy classroom sort of environment has mistakes being not something that's necessarily celebrated, but as part of the learning process, you fail forward from them. You know, some of the things that I do best now are things that I did wrong and I learned how to fix. And so that's true as a math skill and a life skill. When it comes to literacy, I'm sure everyone saw the big news break, I think it was last year, about how we've been teaching reading wrong all this time. And I invite educators to continue to not be what I call victim to the pendulum swing. So there was a lot of important findings. And honestly, those of us in education had been talking about this for the past, I would say, decade already, that children need to be deliberately taught, you know, phonics, phonemic awareness, word attack skills, where it used to be believed in some regard for some reason that research had not yet supported in something that was called whole language that children can intuitively learn how to read. A lot of us in the education field have known this, and we have, you know, supplemented that or changed those things in our programs. But what I will say, and I don't want to have get lost, is the love of reading and teaching children to do what we really want, which is to read for information and to read for enjoyment. And so in some of this craze in teaching word attack skills, I've seen some educators go to the other extreme and only sit and teach, you know, phonics instruction, which we've already seen, I think, for some of us who were in school when Dr. Nava and I were in school, has seen that does turn children off to reading. And so I think what's important is to follow the research, follow the data, and not lose the best parts of all the types of literacy programs. And so to totally move away from teaching what we call reading comprehension skills, like prediction or inferencing or conversations about content, we can't move away from that, because then children, when we talk about productive struggle, it's hard to struggle through something where you don't see the fruits at the end. And so if children are just learning word attack skills and not seeing the big picture of it and not getting to understand how this, you know, oh, I get to read this book that's so interesting and exciting and I, you know, and see the result of it, then they're also not going to persevere through that, because learning has to be what we call relevant. And so that, you know, that certainly is a math skill also, but in literacy also, the word attack skills need to be relevant. And I want children to leave, you know, elementary school loving reading and picking up a book at their leisure. And so I think balancing the two is important. And I don't think throwing out everything we learned about what was called balanced literacy, I don't think that's a healthy approach either.
Wow, there's so much that you covered in that response. I want to delve into it a little bit more and just say some of the take homes that really resonate with me is, one, when you spoke about math and how important it is to fail forward, how important it is for kids to recognize that they won't necessarily get the correct answer right away, building their grit. Who had a fabulous struggle today? Who struggled with a math problem today? And using that as something that is beneficial that they can learn from and grow from and have that kind of growth mindset, rather than just that fixed mindset of I got it wrong or I got it right, that dichotomous thinking. So I love that. I also love the notion of creativity there with the different ways that math is being taught and the order and sequence in which you mention. Another thing that you alluded to, which I love, is mentorship, having the right kind of math mentor that can really help kids work through math struggles. A recent article came out of Harvard University, which spoke about the fact that one of the best things we can do for our children today is to give them some adult mentor, whether it is a coach or whether it's that incredible teacher in a Jewish facility, institution, maybe it's a rabbi, whatever it is, but someone that they can look back on in their elementary or high school years and say, this person had such a unique impact on me. And for each kid to have someone like that. So to have someone like that in math, a subject that some people feel very intimidated by, I can imagine would be incredibly helpful. And also with respect to reading, your discussion of love of reading, one thing I always recommend to parents is, if they have kids who are struggling to read or disinterested in reading, I always say find books that appeal to them. Find subjects that they really love. If they love sports, then find a sports book. It could be a comic book, whatever kind, just to get them excited about reading. And I love how you broke down the different, phonemic awareness approaches, but also the need to contextualize the reading and make it interesting for them. So many good things in just that one response. There's something else that I have to ask you about, because I know we've worked on this.
Wait, I need to come in on the light. You can't talk about libraries.
No, please. Please,
I just
want to say,
Dr. Nava, that you hit on an important other research pendulum swing, which is, I'm sure many, many people have seen that children's libraries have been set up by level. One important change that was made over the past 5 years is that we created high interest sections, and that it's actually good for a child to read a book that might not be exactly on their level, but is a high interest area. If any of the listeners have children who don't love reading, or doesn't come easily to them, a great strategy for parents is to read a book to your child. It could be above grade level. If the child's ready, you could read a page, they could read a page, or you could just read to them before they go to bed, and they'll learn how to read in school, but they'll see the love of reading and the storyline and the enjoyment just by hearing that story with you. Of course, role modeling and reading yourself is always an important message to children.
And that aligns so nicely with a recent New York Times article that came out about exactly that, that reading with your children has such incredible benefits. Even if a kid knows how to read on his or her own, just that opportunity to read together, to have that discourse and that dialogue. And as you said, they read a page, you read a page, and whatever way you do it has such a huge benefit for children. And the question I wanted to ask you next deals with something that we have gone back and forth on. I think this idea of a responsive classroom is a wonderful thing. Some of the details associated with it, we sometimes have discussed and dialogued about, not always agreed on, but those are the most fun discussions to have. So I know we don't have much time left, but can you describe what a responsive classroom is and what are the benefits of it? And then maybe before we end today, we can talk about, one of the places that we have a tiny bit of conflict when it comes to this approach. But just for those who are not familiar with the responsive classroom, if you could explain what it is.
Sure, Dr. Nava. And I love, working with people like Dr. Nava, with Dr. Nava specifically. I think, a person is only a teacher if they're also a student. And I think being part of a learning community, which is something that we very much value at Manhattan Day School, I think makes it a rich environment and only enhances the education for the children. And I think it's very important to have experts in different areas with different backgrounds and different viewpoints who can contribute to what the program looks like. Responsive Classroom is a program that moves educators to cultivate a community within their classroom that is one that will allow children to be learners and healthy participants as like citizens of the world almost, and community members. And so it teaches responsibility and natural consequences, but really cultivates a place of responsibility for the children. I think what we learned through, going back to just research and education, is that just like children need to be deliberately taught phonics, like we talked about, children in many cases need to be deliberately taught What the behavioral expectations are in a classroom. And I think this is something I think Dr. Nava and I agree very strongly on, is that it's very important to teach children what the expectations are. And there's different techniques called, you know, for instance, interactive modeling, where a teacher will model, you know, let's say how to put your books away and sit down on the carpet, and then ask a student to do the same. And then the more important piece, which is one thing that I really love about responsive classroom, is to then have a discussion about why it's important to do this way. When I mentor educators and we talk about rules in the classroom and behavior, what we call behavior management, which is the less preferable way to talk about teaching children pro-social behaviors, you know, I'll say to them, you know, there should be a reason for every rule in your classroom. And if anyone ever says to me, well, what if I don't have a reason for it? I'll challenge them and say, well, I'm wondering if that should be a rule in your classroom. You know, so let's take one that teachers sometimes have to work with children on a lot, and that's to be quiet in the hallways. When you walk in the hallway, you want it to be orderly and you want it to be quiet. If you just focus with children on what they have to do, you have to be quiet in the classroom, and you don't unpack with them why, number one, it's a missed opportunity. And number two, they're not understanding the bigger picture. When you talk to children about the fact that, you know, there are other classes learning, and when we talk, we make it hard for them to learn. You're taking away that teaching them empathy, teaching them how to be responsible. And I think it's also important to put yourself in the children's shoes. One of my favorite responsive classroom video clips that I show teachers is where the teacher is talking about walking in the hallway quietly and says, you know, it's really hard for me when I see my teacher friends to not call out and go, hey, how are you? Because I want to do that. And you're validating that it's not a bad thing that children want to greet their friends. In fact, there are many contexts where we teach that greeting people is polite. And so now we're changing things on them and saying that greeting in a, you know, a really happy, loud way isn't the appropriate behavior in this space. And so it's important to unpack with them why, and then also what to do instead. And so the teacher says, I really am excited to see my teacher friends in the hallway, and I want to call out to them. And so instead, because I don't want to interrupt the classes, I do a quick wave. And then she'll ask the students, so do you think that that's something that you can do? And so the reasons that these are important, and I know we don't have enough time, but Dr. Nava knows as a psychologist, we're teaching them why. We're teaching them that their behavior impacts the community as a whole. We're empathizing with them that it's a totally normal, wonderful thing. I mean, to want to greet your friends. And also, you might see your brother. I mean, kids love running over to their siblings and hugging each other in school. And that's a nice thing. But to teach them that, you know, in this space of the hallway, we behave a little bit differently than we do outside is another important skill for children, because as adults, we don't all behave the same in all the same places. So that's the philosophy of responsive classroom. I think what I love about it is, and again, no approach is always perfect all the time. But what I happen to really like about responsive classroom is instead of a lot of the don't do this with children because it's bad for them, it offers teachers tools and techniques of what to do with them, how to teach these pro-social behaviors. And so Dr. Nava, now you're asking where our point of difference is. I don't know. You want to jump in on that?
Well, I love it. All the parts of responsive classroom that you just mentioned, I totally align with. I love the interactive modeling component that you alluded to. I love the idea of explaining why we're doing what we're doing instead of just saying, this is the rule and that's it. You know, you have to follow it. Offering children an explanation for these things and having them understand it will not only help them in that year in the classroom, but throughout life in understanding how we act in different life situations, and that there's a time and place for each thing. I think the only place where we sometimes, you know, have a difference of opinion is, you know, as an educator myself, I think I started teaching when I was 12. You know, I would find that certain aspects of positive reinforcement could be helpful. And I don't mean, you know, stickers and, you know, kind of physical forms of positive reinforcement, but the use of things like compliments, the use of things, you know, like saying, you know, instead of focusing on the negative, saying, I love how Josh is sitting so nicely, and I love how he's looking up at the board and ready to work. And I'd love to see how many people can do just what Josh is doing. And I know it's hard, and I know it can be complicated to hone in on one student. You don't want to encourage jealousy. You don't want to encourage competition. But I find that even if I say, oh, this half of the room is doing such a great job right now, let's see how quickly we can all be doing a great job, I don't necessarily see that as harmful or deleterious as I think the response of classroom might. So I'd love to hear
you. As I do.
As you do.
Okay, sure. Yeah, no, this is a point of where we see difference. And I will just note that even in the book that we read with our faculty last year, there is a section that says, you know, you don't have to panic if you say something differently, the children will be okay. You know, I don't think extreme forms of anything work. The reason that I don't love that approach is because I always like to think like the long range. So yeah. In the short term, there are a lot of gains to an approach like that. You know, if I like how Nava's sitting, and so Pesha's going to be like, oh, I want her to say that to me, so I want to sit like Nava. And so it works, you know, like it works in the classroom. The piece that I question about it is shifting, you know, where the motivation is coming from.
Yeah.
And so when I think about when children grow up, and they graduate. So I'm an elementary school educator because I love watching children grow up and partnering with their families through their development. You know, that's something that I love about it and knowing them for so many years. And so when I think about children growing up and going out into the world, going on to high school and then into the world, I want the reason that they do things to come from a more wholesome place than pleasing people around them. And so what do I mean by that? So let's say the motivation of the teacher is to have children sit quietly. You know, that seems to be we're walking in the hallway quietly, we're sitting quietly. So I want them to understand that they're allowing everybody to learn by sitting quietly. And I want them to look at their own self. And if we're using competition, they should be in competition with themselves.
Yeah.
And so that number one understands whatever their personal strengths and weaknesses are, because that will look different for every child. You know, just like we know that not everybody is going to get an A on every test. We know that not every kid is going to get an A in the behavior test area, if you will. And that for some children, sitting quietly on a carpet is a very difficult struggle. And to put them up in competition against another child who for them is much easier, we've learned is not helpful to them. And so I'd rather they feel like they themselves are sitting on the carpet because they want to help the learning community, because they themselves want to learn. And so when that doesn't go well, rather than motivating them by pointing out somebody else, I would rather tune them into their internal clock. And as a teacher, you know, either seat that child next to me or whisper to them, you know, what are you feeling right now? Do you need a break? You know, are you having a hard time right now? And kind of have them have autonomy over their body. And so what that, in the short term, it's more difficult. But in the long run, I would say a success with this child is they start squirming on the carpet. They and I have a little signal. They go take a break because they've learned how to moderate their own body and themselves. And then they come back and sit down, and they recognize the reason that they're sitting down and being quiet is not to impress me or to please me in any way, but it's so that they can focus and learn, and that they're not disrupting others from learning. And so it's definitely a harder approach as a teacher. And I'm not saying there isn't value in other approaches. There definitely is. But that is why I personally don't favor that sort of verbal praise. And I think positive reinforcement is important. Dr. Nava, you and I have talked about how our education system is just focused on people's weaknesses rather than their strengths. And I think it's very powerful to give verbal praise to a child that is constructive. And I'm not saying that that shouldn't happen. You know, I think it's important to say to children things like, you know, I noticed you really worked hard today. You know, how does that feel? And kind of throw it back to them and have them feel like, say, oh, it feels good. It feels hard. It was, you know, whatever it is, kind of cultivating in them their internal sort of clock, their internal map, their internal, you know, understanding of themselves. And I just, that's my worldview. And like I said, I appreciate all different views. And I think, you know, Dr. Nava, you know, we talked about just, you know, the different hats that we wear. So, you know, when Dr. Nava comes into the classroom, it's usually because, you know, the systems didn't work for someone, for one of the children, and we need something more than that. And so I think that's a place where token economy systems and rewards are more powerful on the individual basis. But I think if a child doesn't need that, And I want to talk about, you know, what's our ideal setting. I'm coming from the teacher standpoint. I want to set up a classroom in a way that is the most ideal way to do something for the most amount of people.
I love that. And I think that's a super fair and well thought out response. And I think you're exactly right. I think certain situations might call for a token economy at some point, the positive reinforcement at some point. But if you can manage to work through situations without that, I absolutely agree with you that that is the way to go. That you know, using that as an alternative when other things are not functioning or working in the way you hope, I think that is a great time to look into a potential token economy. But first try to really have that internal clock that you mentioned and the community built in such a substantial way. So we are getting to out of time here.
Oh no.
Is there any last thing that you want to mention, either a piece of advice for parents, anything at all that we touched on that you want to say more about, but any last thoughts? This has been such an exciting thing to speak with you. I love what you just said too about strengths, that so many people focus on children's limitations and weaknesses, and to really hone in on the uniqueness of each child and on the strengths of each child is so incredibly important. And I see how you do that in practice, which is really incredible. Any last thoughts that you might want to add before we finish for today?
Sure. Number one, it is an honor to work with you, Dr. Nava. I learn from you every time we talk. So I appreciate our dialogues about productive struggle and about token economy. And I think, you know, I'm a better educator because I work with you. So I want to thank you for that. I guess just to pull all the pieces together, you know, you had mentioned about having an adult, like a solid adult or kind mentor. Of a mentor. And when you were saying that, I was thinking about just, you know, what drives me personally in terms of my own career and life and values. And I just want to put out there to parents and grandparents, if you're listening, not to underestimate your impact. You know, I had the distinct privilege of sitting next to my grandfather every Friday night at our Shabbat table until I was 12 years old. I got to sit next to him. And, you know, there were many things that he said that I took important lessons away from, but it was the story of his life that was the most inspiring. You know, he had escaped the former Soviet Union as a child and come to the United States as a young adolescent, and didn't know a word of English, and kind of navigated a whole new world of balancing sort of the traditional Jewish upbringing he had, and then his total curiosity and thirst for knowledge, literature, music. He was just an amazing educator and himself an amazing student. And by the time, you know, he had gone through high school and college, he had had rabbinic ordination and a PhD in education and really kind of focused his life on building schools in the Jewish community and thinking about the future. And so understanding the struggles he went through and the values that were so important to him continue to motivate and inspire me today, even though I'm a middle-aged woman and he has passed away, you know, years ago. His story, his life, I can hear his voice, you know, inspire me. I have, you know, there's he used to put a sticker in every one of his books that says, you know, Hebrew phrase on it and that, you know, that the world is built on loving kindness. And then a phrase from Walt Whitman's poem, when I give myself. And I actually have that framed on my desk because, you know, it really embodied his life of service and the gratitude he had for everything he received and what he gave back to the world as a result, to the children, the next generation. And so his story motivates me. And so what I say to parents and grandparents, do not underestimate the impact that you have on the future in those small daily interactions with your children and grandchildren, and just in being open with them about your struggles, your story, your life, your values. Even if you don't see it in the short term, in the long run, it really, really impacts them.
I love that. And I really see you as a mentor. And I see you as someone who's a mentor, not just for me as a parent and someone who works with you, but for so many parents and so many children and educators. And you're really passing on your grandfather's legacy. And that is such an incredible thing. So I can't thank you enough for being here today, taking the time to chat. I hope we can do it again sometime soon. And
anytime, Dr. Nava.
Thanks a million.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. You may want to check out the brand new popular Bashert card game at www.thebashert.com to forge meaningful connections with others during this time. You may also want to check out the Real Abilities Omnibus comic book collection for your kids on bookbaby.com or amazon.com. It will keep them busy while teaching them about kindness, empathy, and about the beauty of difference. Wishing you all an incredible and meaningful day.